Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. It is always a riveting hour when John McMurtry comes on, and it certainly will be today. We want to discuss a very important topic. It's certainly one that I've written about in various forms in many articles that I've written, the idea that America is a destructive force. I've said it many different ways. I simply cannot imagine another nation in world history that's done more harm to more people than America, and at the same time claiming itself the credentials of a democracy. I mean, when Stalin did it, when Hitler did it, when Attila the Hun did it, you know, the folks of the past, they never claimed any democratic credentials, but America flies them high. Of course, it's all a big lie. I use that term often, the big lie, capital B, capital L. And I must say that Israel is a very well up there junior partner. You could add other countries as well. There's no question that Britain is there. Canada plays its role. France plays its role. The president of France, Francois Hollande, is taking victory laps in Jerusalem today after he shot down. I don't really know what the nuclear agreement with Iran was all about because only sketchy details came out. I wrote plenty about it, and I don't expect much when all is said and done. But anyway, Hollande is in Jerusalem. I believe his foreign minister is there as well, Laurent Fabius. He's the one who was in Geneva who shot it down officially. But I repeat, I didn't expect anything to come out of that. And when the next round begins next week, Thursday, I believe, I don't really expect much to come out of that, regardless of what's announced. But behind the scenes, America pulls the strings. You know, you can blame France. I used the phrase in one of my articles that France played bad cop in Geneva. Well, France wouldn't have played any bad cop if America said, don't you dare. France wouldn't dare cross America. I think even France and most other nations consider America as the indispensable nation when it comes to advancing imperialism, waging aggressive wars, and so on. Well, I kind of go along with that. John, I want to let you take over and jump into this, but it's a big topic, and there's no question that America is an extremely destructive force, and I don't know what the devil we're going to do to stop it.
Well, I mean, America is a destructive, violent force at a systematic level, pretty well on all domains, as we'll find out today in our discussion, I'm sure. You, in a sense, have been dealing with this problem one way or the other, but downstream in the sense of what's the latest outrage, what's the latest eco-genocidal initiative that is underway. And you mentioned, well, it's not only America, but, I mean, Israel, and of course Israel is allied with America. And so much of this, you know, when you discuss this with people in the special status of the United States as the most life-destructive power in the history of the planet, you're inclined to get back as a response, well, you know, it's human nature and they have greater technological powers than past empires. And they're just doing what we've always done as human beings, and then you get into a pessimistic riff about human nature. That's the standard response. And indeed, when you go back, I mean, Israel started it before. I'm going to just quote a line that has stood out from me ever since. And when, as a younger man, I read the Bible from beginning to end, that is the Jewish and the Christian Bible, from beginning to end. And the line has always stuck in my mind, this the one from Genesis where he says, the Yahweh, the Lord, the tribal God, says, well, you take the whole of Canaan to own in perpetuity. This is from the tribal God Yahweh. And indeed, they go ahead. And in Exodus, it's the instruction is given from the Lord, which is, of course, usually religion, as Durkheim long ago pointed out, is a projection of the collective the collective self-conception of a society as the almighty God. They just project their own status and place in the world and their ambitions, and then project that on to an almighty transcendental God, and then behave with the justification of that God. And thus, in the case of this tribal God, we have the pact. You know, no pact. You cannot have any pact, says Yahweh, with the peoples who already occupy the land. You've got to exterminate them. And then he goes into a list. You've got to exterminate the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and so forth. Well, I guess that it ends with the Jebusites. So that's Exodus 23, verse 22. So we have this as a long in Western civilization, or you might say Judeo-Christian civilization, but then you see Islam is also founded on conquest, imperial conquest. And so you get into, and this is, I think, the main closed circle of thought, is that it all comes back to human nature. Well, it doesn't. It comes back to the game that you're playing in the society. It comes back to the social order that you are living under. In short, how you live as a society, and that's decided by the rules of the society. And even if you project them onto a God telling you go slaughter all these people to take their land, it's nevertheless you doing it, you as a society doing it, and it is your rules that permit it and indeed prescribe it. And I'm just going to give another quote from in the background here, bringing us right up to the present. There was a woman who was who's an investigative journalist in Mexico, Anibal Hernandez, and she has investigated the drug cartels in Mexico, and she says something very interesting that really expresses the point I'm trying to make. It is not human nature. It is never human nature. It has nothing to do with humanity. Otherwise, you couldn't explain how something like, say, Norway exists, or why the Venezuela reforms exist and so forth, because they all go the opposite direction. It's the nature of the system that you have constructed for yourselves and you continue to reproduce. And so she says about, you know, the terrible violence. I mean, basically, Mexico has become a country that is pervaded with drug cartel violence. And she says, well, the violence of the cartels are not the disease. They are a symptom of the disease. So again, you could go to the cartels. Well, there's always drug dealers. There's always been drugs, and they're always trying to get the most for themselves, and they're always murder other people in order to get it, and so forth. And it's back to the human nature. And she takes it further, and it's rather well put, I think. The cartels cannot operate for a moment without the support of the officials, the bureaucrats, the politicians and police officers, and the bankers to launder their money, indeed maybe invest it. That's my addition. And so, and bankers, you know, launder the narco money. These people let the narcos do, and I would say, well, let's go further. The system is built, it builds it in, because it's just a self-maximizing money sequence, and we've talked about this before. Self-maximizing private money sequences taking over everything at every level and have nothing in mind and no committed function whatever except to multiply the money in their private hands. And she is on to this point when she says, the narcos are not the ultimate issue. It is the cancer of the system. So she has picked up, I guess, or maybe independently discovered, the idea that what we're dealing with here is a cancer system, and that cancer system is constructed rule by rule. It's constructed right now. You know, we're doing it further, of course, with the new trade agreements. That's always the thing. You go through, it's not a trade agreement at all. It's a treaty from on top, organized in secret and imposed on the people by armed force and political propaganda, and really they have no choice in it. And that is always being added to, so that with the Canada, European Union, and now the U.S. and the European Union, they're just doing more of the same, more of NAFTA, only even more so. They're trying to make sure that every domain, every single domain on Earth and every level of human life organization and need is controlled by them, and you can't do anything about it, and you can sue for loss of profit opportunities or any legislation that attempts to stop you. So this is very much a system thing. It is not a human nature thing. The system is not only inherited from the past, as Marx once said, in a nightmare weighing on the brains of the living. That's true. It comes from the past, but it's in this system in particular, it's never stopping its construction of itself to take more and to repress everything that resists, and to get rid of anything that isn't playing into the money sequences to more for the top 1 to 10%. Anything that gets in the way or anything that costs will be eliminated, and that's why the food stamps, you know, right to the food stamps, that's why they're being taken away. That's why you're having this huge, you know, just incapable of managing public health by market means, and that's what the Obama administration was forced to do. And you know, the only system that ever works is one that has a single payer system or has public, as in Canada, it's not really socialist or anything. But what it means is that everybody just has a card. You know, it's like a credit card, only you don't have to pay, and a medical card, and all your medical expenses are paid by the public. It's a pooled risk system, and all are paid by the public. And it's much cheaper. It's $1,000 per person more expensive in the U.S. and in the past they've covered. They've left 20% of the people. 50 million people have been left out and uninsured altogether. And they have higher death rates. They have higher disease rates and higher infant mortality rates and so forth. So again, what you're seeing is an institutional violence, not a human nature thing, not something that people are spontaneously doing because they're evil people and not nice people. It's because the system builds it in, and the system has built in life attack at every level. And those two examples, like taking away the people's food stamps, by the way, you know, down, they $1.40 a meal is what you're going to get with your food stamps, or you already got, and they're going to chop that down lower. I mean, it's just, you know, starvation. That's fine, because what good are those people doing the money sequences? And so they're thrown under the bus. The medical public health care, it's an insult to the world. It's the only developed country in the world that doesn't have public health care. Well, you marketize, you put it into the same old system, and that same old system of the invisible hand is always, you know, people choose, and the people choose by their self-maximization, and they all compete against one another to get the best price and so forth. It's all built in, and of course what happens is you can't run it at all. It fails, because the failure is built into the system. It has never worked. It has never worked. It's never worked in one domain of human life need whatsoever. And so my first point would really be, we're not dealing with human nature here. We're dealing, as you say, with America as a destructive force, but it's not just America. It's wider than America. America, of course, has been the leader in imposing this system, which is a carcinogenic system by its nature.
Oh, indeed, John. You touched on so many things that are so important to me. I would mention, I've written a number of times on the trade deal that you mentioned, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I have a new article coming out tomorrow on it. I call it TPP, NAFTA on steroids.
Yeah.
And in the article, I go back and I discuss briefly the enormous harm that NAFTA caused, all the promises that were made. And I love it when I can quote a source like the New York Times that praised NAFTA before it was passed.
Jobs.
Yeah. Oh, my good. Jobs is right. It couched its terms a little bit in one of the editorials I quoted from, where, you know, it might not be a panacea, but it will lift the economy of Mexico. It will create jobs in America. Well, millions of jobs were lost. You know, a lot of cheap jobs were created in Mexico.
Yeah.
Canada lost jobs. America lost jobs. And this monstrosity, this Trans-Pacific Partnership, the good news about it, John, is that the Asian nations, at least some of them, are very unhappy with some of the destructive provisions. And the only thing we've learned, for the most part, is leaked information, although WikiLeaks just put out a little bit more leaked information. I mean, this thing is an absolute monster.
Imagine calling it democratic.
Oh, it's not democratic.
It is completely negotiated by corporate lawyers who are working for the private sector.
And
it's all,
with,
everything's kept secret. This is democratic. There's no sense of democratic that even goes near it. And yet that will be the excuse when the heads start getting bashed in if they don't get along with it, will be, and you know, and wars made because they're not going along with it, because that's the real secret to all these Middle East wars, is that they're not going along with the system. Although they have gone, you know, they've bent over backwards, been neoliberalizing, but they want it all. They want their water, they want their oil, they want their everything. And then they call it democratic, as you, that's another major point you made in your introductory talk there, that they call this democratic, demo meaning for the people. And it is completely secret. It's by 1/1,000,000th of a percentage of the population negotiating it in secret, representing private interests only and solely to maximize profit opportunities for transnational corporations. Calling it democratic. You have gone so far beyond even Orwell now that it's, you know, the head, the body trembles at the absurdity of it all. Democratic.
It really is shocking. Even Congress has been shut out, with the exception of minimal portions of this act. The congressperson, the senator or congressperson alone, with no aides, has been allowed to go into a private place outside their office and read this minimal piece of information that's being provided, take very sketchy notes at most, and the language, of course, when lawyers write these things, you really need a lawyer to interpret a lawyer.
Oh, yeah, they're really...
So it's hard for, you know, just an average person to go and read this thing and understand
and
exactly what it's saying.
And the thousands of pages long with their appendices. Yeah, I have read the whole thing,
indeed.
But I think I'm almost alone in having read the whole thing, at least the NAFTA. Yeah.
Well, let me give you a punchline up to this moment. I mean, this could change any time. But a couple of hundred members of Congress are very, very unhappy about this, and they've made their feelings known. And they've made their feelings known to the extent that if this thing comes up, it would have to – well, Obama wants it fast-tracked, which means you just ram it through Congress with no amendments, and you vote up or down, no changes, and a couple hundred members of Congress.
One. All or nothing,
All or nothing. They're so upset that they simply don't want to go along with this. I mean, they're basically saying if you force this on us, you're going to get a no vote. So
is that
Obama
bipartisan,
has literally,
by the way, it must be bipartisan, that opposition, which is a hopeful thing, that you're going to have a bipartisan where people still have some sense that their country isn't just totally a plaything of
transnational. I think it's mostly Republican, John, but there are Democrats that have joined the Republicans.
Yes, that's
important.
So it
is bipartisan, but, you know, it's a little bit tough to oppose your president. It's a lot easier if you're the opposition.
I mean, he's, you know, he may not even want to, but he's, as we know, is a puppet of forces outside him right from his election on.
Oh, absolutely.
And even if he wanted to stop it, it'd be very difficult for him to. You know, Steve, in the Constitution, as you know, a treaty, and this is all made under treaty law, which means that it bypasses any democratic accountability whatsoever. And that's in the Constitution. If you've made a treaty, then that becomes part of the Constitution. That is built into the Constitution. And any violation of that treaty, you know, they won't pay attention to, say, a treaty or a covenant on human rights, but they will pay attention to the covenant, the covenant among transnational corporations to all fleece their people of everything. This, I don't know why this hasn't arisen, in short, as a constitutional issue. You are changing our Constitution on us again, and you're doing it, you know, at the sacrifice of the common interests of the people in all the ways that have already been demonstrated. Why isn't somebody making a constitutional case? This writes in as having the power of the Constitution behind it. And you haven't even consulted it. Well, and, you know, it has all the totally dictatorial, despotic form. I mean, I could go through it all. It's in secret. It's all or nothing. You don't have any chance of changing it, and so forth. And it never has any accountability to the people, whether they support it or not. And there's no response possible. There's no feedback loop of being corrected by disasters. And this is built into with the constitutional power, and nobody's whispering a word about that. And that's the one I would really, anybody out there, anybody who's in the legal profession or whatever, in politics, why isn't this a major constitutional issue as you sacrifice the interests of the American people even more under secret, despotic, one-sided, all-or-nothing, armed force back, no consultation, prescriptions thousands of pages long?
Oh, I agree, John. I think the idea of fast-tracking legislation should be unconstitutional. Congress has the power to offer amendments to legislation. This is part of the debate that goes on in Congress to come up with a final a bill.
Yeah.
And if you tell Congress you cannot do this, I mean, that really strikes me as being unconstitutional.
Yes, yes. So there's nothing constitutional about it. There's nothing democratic about it. It's the opposite of all of them in performance. We have a track record of this, and yet nobody's saying a word. And that's when you you wonder, why is this? Why is it? Has nobody seen it? Well, if anybody has seen it, like we are seeing it, if anybody has seen it, you won't get any corporate mass medium reporting it. They just won't report it if they have seen it. But I worry that people haven't even seen it yet, because someone like Nader, I don't know that he's a courageous and a very intelligent, really a hero of the American culture. I haven't heard him say anything about this. You're making this into a constitutional commitment when nothing whatsoever has been agreed to, even at the legislative level, except an all-or-nothing prescription forged by other people into which no accountability to even elected representatives who themselves are corporately funded has had a voice, let alone the people in any kind of choice. Let's say an election, that you run an election. We had an election over this in Canada, over NAFTA. There was a tremendous opposition to it. In fact, it was 60% or more of the population was opposed to NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
And it was negotiated in secret, all the same stuff. And, it was the prototype for everything that's happened since. It was very, very important. Well, originally it was the Canada-US Trade Agreement, and then, of course, it came to the North American with Mexico. The FTA was the original one. And that, in 1988, that was radically opposed by the people. They couldn't sell it. They tried to sell it, and of course they tried to sell it with the lies, the big lies about jobs, jobs, jobs. And then we had people on the ground. I was one of them, but not. There was thousands of people who were resisting this. Well, we have a three-party system. And so the opponents to it divided the vote, and this is what's still going on now in Canada, and that's why Canada is in the parlous state it is in. They can get by, the ruling government can get by with effectively 25% of the electoral vote, because of, a lot of people don't vote in the elections, and, just like Reagan, that this core 22 to 25% that they can count on is what, one of the founders of the old Progressive Conservative Party, one of the big movers inside it, he said privately, because he was a friend, that we cannot afford to lose the bigot vote. They know very well there's a bigot vote out there, and it'll be up to 25%, and you can always count on them to vote for what you stand for, and you always got to have bigotry causes like imprison more people, hang them, stop. You throw away the key, all the stuff that we've seen go on in the States goes on here. And they can get by when you have the vote divided three ways. They get the vote with less than a majority of the population on everything they're doing now. And they are rewriting the whole social democrat contract, between the workers and the employers that have been developed over 50 years. Well, the same thing is in the States. What's divided the vote in the states, of course, is that you don't even get 50% or hardly 50% of your people out to vote anymore. You know, so, you know, what democratic legitimacy does this thing have? And then what they know they can do, if they control the airwaves, and I mean by visual as well as verbal, all the methods of controlling the airwaves and the signals and the symbolic understandings that are communicated amongst people through the public. If they control that and they control the bigot vote, they always have enough to get by, and it doesn't make much difference whether you get an Obama or somebody else, because they're still corporate, you know, I'm searching for a word that's not insulting, but basically corporate puppets. And so we have basically here, as you pointed out too, with the fast track thing, that really brings it, I'm glad you emphasized it, because I wasn't emphasizing it, and that really brings, lays bare the anti-democratic nature of this whole thing that is going to be built into the Constitution and will be irreversible. Even if they say it can be reversed, it won't be reversed because of all those powers. So I just wish there was a constitutional hue and cry. If you tried to change the Constitution now, I mean, in any progressive way, say make certain parts of the Commerce Clause pay attention to the health and well-being of the people as one of its conditions, as they should in these trade agreements, I mean, it wouldn't be hard to do, but there would be murder to pay in the sense of the screaming and yelling and the propaganda and dictatorship and screaming socialists and all kinds of nonsense nonstop. But here they're doing it right into the Constitution with these treaties under the Constitution. They're as much a part of the law as the Constitution itself. And nobody's saying a word. And then that's what worries me, that the host, the life host, the public life host, the people themselves, it's not just that they're being shut up, that as with a, you know, as with a carcinogenic occupation at the micro level of life organization, that the immune system is just switched off. It can't cope anymore. It's overwhelmed. That's my worry. I've got, like you, I struggle on, like lots of people, we struggle on. We know there's no other way to do it, no matter which way it goes, but it, you know, you worry when you see something like this go by and no one say anything about the Constitution, when normally they'd be screaming and yelling.
I think ordinary people don't think of the law or the Constitution, John.
Yeah.
But another classic example of something that I think is unconstitutional is what's called the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. One of the provisions is that everybody is mandated to buy health insurance. You don't have a choice. If you don't want to buy it, you have to buy it, or you'll be assessed. You'll be penalized. It's fairly small the first year. But
they're screaming and yelling about that, Steve. The Republicans, that you're right about that, obviously. You're always right about what facts you report. But the Republicans are screaming and yelling about that very loud and clear. And that's the one that's almost stopped it. And as you know, of course, and you've written so well on these things, the Supreme Court said, well, it's a form of tax, and taxes are mandatory too, and you don't have a choice. And that was their way of getting around the problem. But basically, it's this, you know, it's forced consumption of the corporate product. And yes, you're right, but at least there we've had a hue and cry that may indeed have made a difference in whether this plan worked or not. I mean, by the way, let me pose a question on this as we follow this one issue of the Affordable Care Act. Do you think there's been any internal sabotage? I haven't really followed it well. I knew in advance that it was going to fail because a market system can't, you know, it's blind to all matters of collective life requirement. It's blind a priori to it, so it's not going to work. But do you think there's actually been sabotage? Because it seems to have gone so badly wrong. When normally they can get their laws right, like with the Patriot Act, they just, you know, they'll just ram it through. Or do you think it's just they're just incompetent because it's an area of public health and you just can't manage it.
John, I never thought about sabotage, but you have to wonder.
Yeah.
They had about 3 years to get ready for this.
Yeah.
I mean, they have technical experts that ought to be able to design a website without a problem. I mean, no matter how complicated it is, you know, they were expecting millions of visitors to the site, but you get sites like Google that have much heavier traffic, and I don't ever remember hearing of a problem that Google couldn't be accessed. You have other heavily trafficked websites, and this thing was absolutely so fouled up. I mean, I don't know when they're going to get it settled. I don't know whether even after they say it'll be fixed, whether it really will be fixed. It's a very interesting point, John. Maybe there was sabotage on it.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and pick right up. Welcome back. Speaking with John McMurtry, talking about America as the most destructive force, and it certainly is. I mean, we're talking about domestic issues, John. Of course, something very, very important. I mean, we could add all of the financial crimes to the domestic issues, and the fact that literally there's been a government Wall Street conspiracy to transfer enormous amounts of individual wealth from ordinary people. You know, what's called the 99%. Call it the 90%. But from that category of people, which is the great majority, to a very selective group, which really isn't the 1%, it's really about the 1/10 of 1%, the super millionaires, the billionaires, and they literally, in a recent article I wrote, John, from 2009 to, I guess, the end of 2012, the billionaires of the country, I think, doubled in numbers, and they also doubled their wealth. Well, ordinary people really lost out. They lost out to inflation. They lost out to lost jobs. They lost out to eroding wages. Good full-time jobs disappear. Low-paying part-time, poor benefit jobs replace them. People need two jobs to barely be able to get by. And then you have things like cutting food stamps and the rest. I mean, it's a horrible situation. And of course, we can get into the issue of imperial wars.
What I thought, Steve, where, you know, you mentioned, well, you know, we didn't deal with the imperial wars a lot, but the domestic situation, what we've left out is the part, and it's, you know, it's standard to leave it out everywhere, is what's happening to the younger generation and the children. I mean, now children can be buy corporate products of one sort or another. There's been a sea change in you know, it used to be that schools and parents were the only people who really had access to or governed the control of children's time. That has all changed so that 9 hours a day on average in the States are in front of corporate television screens of one sort or another. And they have basically, the upbringer of today's children are now multinational corporations, and they abuse children. I've had to coin a term, actually, corporate child abuse. They abuse children worse than children, as you know, generationally speaking, have ever been abused in the history of humanity. They can be assaulted, diseased, killed by the pervasive corporate foods, drugs, beverages, all toxic in many ways that one could go on for a long time describing, and then perverted by mindless violence entertainment in many, many modes, you know, not only on television shows, of course, but on all these games, so much so that that even the American Medical Association said, and I'm really surprised, but this is quoted in Joel Bacon's great book, The Assault on Childhood, a professor of law who wrote The Corporation, and he quotes the American Medical Association saying what I'm so glad and surprised, though, that they've been this. They said, aggressive and violent thought and behavior are systematically induced in virtually all children by corporate games. That's let alone what the diseasing is happening through obesity and so forth, through the junk foods they're feeding and pervading everywhere. You can hardly go in a central city now and find any real foods anymore. And so then they're deployed as dead-end labor. They have no future prospects. And then they're dumped into a corporate future, if they get educated, of debt, and you've written about this too, of debt enslavement for, you know, the cost of an education. And then after that, meaningless work, because interesting work, if it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't contribute to maximize the private corporate money sequences transnationally occupying the world and growing and multiplying, then it's disposable. That's the end of it. So the abuse of children is that this is the one, and the young and the next generation without a future, that's built into the system. And that's the one that concerns me most of all. I mean, it's hard to say most of all when you think of the imperial wars and you think especially the ecological despoliation, just ecocidal practices at every level. You know, from the climate's the one that's talked about, but they don't talk about that 99% of the goods corporate products are junk within, 99% are junk or waste within 6 weeks. And very little of it is of use anyway. There's no durable use to them. So, I mean, we can go into the eco side, which, you know, is, I guess, on the macro level of all life on Earth, that's the worst abuse that's going on. But the abuse of the younger generation of our species and human civilization so far as it is, has advanced, is the one that worries me most. And we've talked about this, I guess, too. You know, you've talked about and I've talked about, you know, how we went to school and, the support systems that were in place to do it. And they're just not, nor the jobs. I mean, the livelihoods, you're not insured of a livelihood or of a family anymore. And so what, you know, the suicide rate of children is and teeners especially, as they come to realize what's happening to them, that there's just no future. There's an epidemic of teenage attempted and successful suicides, an epidemic. It's never been so high. And so that's just one phenomenon of it. And then it's all driven, of course, that you can feed them junk foods that are going to cause them obesity, and then maybe a diabetes where they have to have their legs chopped off, as has happened to a friend of mine. You know, this kind of life situation that you're in as a young person is just, I mean, it's overwhelming, and then all of it's being guaranteed, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership is just guarantee that force, that destructive force of selling your products, as, you know, did with cigarettes. It's a marvelous success story with cigarettes. They're addicting everybody now on the planet, even though things have happened on the local level. They've just shot up and multiplied on. And so you force the junk food, force the toxic products, force the killer commodities into everybody's markets as free trade, and you do it in all the ways that we've described earlier, you know, a completely despotic system. And nothing in all these, the idea of a future generation or the idea of young people doesn't exist. You can go through all these trade corporate treaties and basically just to allow them to do anything they want to their peoples, you know, across borders, that there's not a mention of the word even workers. I mean, it's just children. The idea doesn't even compute to this system, this meta program that is destroying the world. So we have probably the worst of all the offenses, of all the violence, the institutional violence. It's not violence by individuals and as in the old days, or even violence by the role of the father as in the patrio potestas of old days, where he had the right of life and death over the child, as in Abraham over Isaac and so forth, that was acceptable. it's much worse. It's that now everybody can get killed. Everybody can get diseased as long as we make a profit out of it. There's no limit on it. There's no law allowed against it. Japan tried to stop it when they made, you know, started making pictures of teenage girls smoking and saying, now you're your own baby or something like that, appealing to their, you know, appealing to their instincts of independence. Because you're just dealing here with, what you're dealing with is the ideal propaganda stooge for ads. I mean, when you think of the child and adolescent fear of being left out, when you think of their addictive desires for more sugar, we have enough of that, but they, you know, they're born being fed it all along. And that's the key. It's not just sugar, but salt and fat, is to addict them. All the products that are out there now are calculated to addict to them, whatever the harmful effects. And they have a primeval fascination with the images of violence and destruction around them. Any kid, it's very interesting to observe children, and one of my fields has been education, to observe how they respond to violence. I mean, it really does, as it does us, fascinate them. But it fascinates them in a very primeval way. And so they just sit locked in watching all these, you know, they've watched 15,000 murders and terrorisms and tortures by within a year of their early life. And then, of course, they're craving for attention in stereotype forms. That's just pretty standard with little kids, especially with the teenagers. And so they're just a feeding frenzy bowl for these corporate products to pump out with absolutely no health standards permitted, and going across now all societies. And then they have, of course, a restless compulsion to distraction that you can get them hooked in a hurry without them even knowing it. And maybe deepest of all about child is the black hole ego doubts. They doubt who they are. You know, that's, you remember yourself. When you're going through, you're not sure who you are. You're trying to make some sort of identity out of it. But the only thing, which, by the way, as a young male, I recognized that the only way I got identity was through that people would pay attention to you was through competitive sport, especially if you were explosive and actually were able to injure people by the nature of the explosive play. That in any case, kids are looking for identity, and of course, so they're just the perfect victim of the pervasive corporate advertising, which runs through one way or another 9 hours a day on average of what they're watching on the screens. And the ultimate protection role, you might say the ultimate role of government from the beginning, has been to protect the young and to protect the future of your people. And that has just been abolished. So that's the one that worries me most of all domestically everywhere. And, of course, the U.S. corporate transnational corporations are at the head of it all.
Well, kids are commodities, John, and I'm concerned just the way you are. We're literally a generation of youth are being robbed of the opportunities that we had. They may not have been perfect, but they were so different way back when we were growing up. Somebody like myself, I mean, a kid from I could call it a nondescript family, just a lower middle income family, and I had really nothing going for me, but I was able to get into two good schools when they were very affordable. And I mean, kids simply can't do that today. I didn't understand the notion of going into debt. I took a very small loan in graduate school, a couple of $100s. I mean, even when the dollar was worth a lot more than it is today, a couple of $100s was nothing. I easily got rid of the loan in my first year of work, which was 1960.
Now you're a debt slave.
Can I read you a line? In 1956, We're coming up on the 50th anniversary of Jack Kennedy's assassination, and I've got an article already written. I'll get it out either on the 22nd or maybe the day before. I call it simply Remembering Jack Kennedy. I've written about him before, but he was my commencement speaker as a junior senator from Massachusetts in 1956, and I honestly don't remember his talk, but I looked it up and I wrote about it, and the last he concluded his talk saying this very briefly, and this is at the end of my article. I say he ended by quoting an English mother. She wrote to the provost of Harrow saying, quote, "Don't teach my boy poetry. He is going to stand for Parliament." And then Kennedy said, quote, "Well, perhaps she was right, but if more politicians knew poetry, if more poets knew politics, I am convinced the world would be a much better place in which to live on this commencement day of 1956.
Can you imagine that being said today?
Oh, impossible.
Yeah.
Impossible.
That's how far we've come down. It's really disturbing.
Well, that comment really moves me. It really moves me. Again, it's impossible to hear politicians talk this way. And I remember that day so vividly, John, because it was an unusually hot June day, around the 16th of June, and in a cap and gown that's black, of course, that the that just radiates the extra heat. I mean, it was a very uncomfortable. I wanted to get the thing over with and get that cap and gown off of me. I think it was in the 90 degrees, something in the 90s,
yeah.
And I don't remember a word he said, but when I went back and looked up his speech and read it, it was a marvelous speech. He quoted notables from history, people that deserve to be quoted. It was a very erudite speech. Again, it's completely different from the way politicians speak today.
Yeah, learning meant something.
It really did mean something.
Yeah, and so that the people he surrounded himself, like the Canadian John Kenneth Galbraith, who was a very cultured man.
Oh, indeed.
That was, you know, his appeal, just bridging from the last topic about the young one, we're still on it. That was, I think, his tremendous appeal, was that he was a young guy, a very vital young man. I mean, imagine he's just in his early 40s and he's president of the United States. And I can remember when I was at the time in doing my PhD at London, University College London, and the guy saying when he got assassinated, or maybe it was referring to any case, some people, just another bourgeois politician. And I said, he was much more than that, because people identified. You might say the ideals were hypocritical or whatever you might say, but his presence on the world stage was a representative of the younger generation, in a position of in a position of charisma and power to decide, that actually I think held the hopes of the whole younger generation. And his assassination is, I think. What do you think about that assassination? Do you think, I mean, it seems to me it's pretty hard to explain in any other way than the way that the official explanation doesn't seem to have any plausibility to it.
It was absolutely a state-sponsored assassination. Yeah. I quote a lot of information. James Fetzer, who's been on this program, has done a lot of research, and I read some of what he wrote, and I quote him in my article. Some of it gets very technical, and I don't want readers' eyes to glaze over, so I passed over that. But one thing that sticks in my mind right now, John, was it was impossible for the rifle that Oswald owned to have killed Kennedy. The official report said a high velocity weapon killed him. Well, Oswald's weapon was not high velocity. Also, there was strong evidence that he wasn't shot twice.
Well,
he was shot four times.
Yeah, the evidence. You have Jim Fetzer on your show, and he's an expert on this as well. I mean, it just doesn't, you know, as with the official conspiracy theory of 9/11, the official one really has no plausibility. I mean, it just, and of course, they did the same thing even, you know, where you just lock out any other evidence, but that has been better covered, really, than 9/11 has been covered. But I was just where he represented a youthful ideal of the younger generation, and when he got I think that was understood, and that he was a guy that was capable in that position. He was capable of taking on the CIA. He was capable of taking on the war, the military-industrial complex. And, you know, of course, some people say, well, indeed, he was trying to do that, and there are, there is evidence that he was doing things in this regard. He was capable of stopping the invasion of Cuba, and really, in fact, did by not providing the air cover and so forth. So we have maybe there, you know, when did it all begin? That certainly seems to me the killing of the youthful hope. Very deliberate act.
Well, there were lots of reasons.
You're going to be that this system, this corrupt system, is going to be safe.
John, there were lots of reasons for wanting to kill him.
Yeah.
He wanted to reform the Federal Reserve. He deplored the CIA. He said he really wanted to tear it into a million pieces and get rid of it.
Yeah.
He opposed the oil depletion allowance. The oil companies went bonkers over that.
Yeah.
The big one in my mind was that he wanted to end the involvement in Southeast Asia.
Well, that's the military-industrial complex.
Oh, exactly.
The tribes can only
exactly.
live on war.
Yeah. He wanted to remove a thousand troops about 6 weeks before he was killed. He wanted them all out of Southeast Asia by the end of 1965, when things were just heating up. And he instructed his Geneva representative, Avril Harriman, as far as the situation in Laos at the time. He said to him in very strong terms, "I want to make this clear. I want no involvement in Laos." I mean, he wanted out of war. He transformed himself from a cold warrior on election to a peacemaker, and that was absolutely, I mean, he knew he was in trouble. He knew he could be assassinated.
Yeah.
He told people around him, and yet he took the risk anyway, and he was right. He didn't survive 3 years in office, and they certainly did murder him. They shot him in front. They shot him in back. And there's a whole bunch of stuff, and I don't know it all, but there's so much evidence to prove that it was a state-sponsored assassination.
Yeah.
Oswald was a convenient patsy.
And all those problems that he was standing up for the future, excuse me, Steve, all those problems are with us today, compounded many times, all of them, many times.
Well,
and that was a really steering moment of the future. And we have, you know, remember the Kennedy sort of, the people that were high on Kennedy, and part of the Kennedy system, like the guy who wrote his speeches, were so high on Obama, they thought it was going to be a return of the Kennedy years, where we do have a young man, we have appearing to have a courageous man, he represents the blacks, etc. And then, of course, we can see, you know, I have an article in front of me now that I'm just reading, where the argument is, and I think it's true, and I guess I've made it my own way too, that the people at the top, and even the corporations, don't have any choice in the matter. This is the way the system works, and they might even. By the way the system works, by the meta program of its decision apparatus, which is always to self-maximize the foreign interests as well as the domestic interests of the large corporations and banks as your first and only law of behavior. And you only get in if you are capable of doing that, and doing that with your eyes closed to everything else. That we really have here, the assassination of Kennedy was built, one might say, and I think in a way you are suggesting, was built into the system. He had to go.
He had to go.
Because of that system. Now, the system itself is open to choice. We can change the system. And the fact that we can change the system was made very clear by the fact that Kennedy was assassinated. If they didn't think you could change the system and change it a lot towards the better, where it actually isn't a life-blind killer machine, they were so that they risked, the biggest illegal murderous act of all, killing your president, a very popular president, because they knew very well you can change the system. And so that choice still exists. There's always a choice space towards that. I'd like to see, for example, the constitutional issue brought up over this Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, etc. We talk about the ways in which it can be changed. I don't know why I continue to hope that it will, but he, in a way, proves that the system can be changed because they had to kill him to stop it.
It really came down to that, and ordinary people can make incredible changes, and it's happened in America before. That's why I never lose hope, John, because if America could end slavery when it was thought to be impossible, and it wasn't the Civil War that ended slavery, it was a small group of determined people that simply wouldn't accept anything less.
Right.
Well, if that can happen, then anything good can happen today, even though the system is so much more firmly entrenched. We better change the system, John. We're either going to change the system, or the system is going to destroy us. It really comes down to
To even take the future out of that is destroying us.
It's destroying us,
absolutely.
We are just about out of time.
It's going to go before it's turned.
Oh, indeed, John. I'm waiting for the music to set up. I think it's warming up right now.
We leave on a note of yes.
Maybe we can continue this next month when you come back on, because this is a major, major topic.
There are so many strands to it.
And there'll be so much going on between now and December, John, that this will be a wonderful thing to pick up on and just continue. I really fear the possibility of a war with Iran. So much more going on here at home. Police state laws, maybe more to follow. The possibility of declaring martial law if there's serious trouble. I mean, it's a very, very serious situation, and people need to be alerted to it.
Yeah.
John, many, many thanks. I look forward to next month.
Thank you, Steve.
Join us every Friday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.